I grew up on a farm.
I was a pretty gay little boy.
We met on Facebook Marketplace.
Did you notice that the comedian in that clip, he never spoke?
You're very funny, by the way.
No. But my wife doesn't agree with you.
And that type of innovative approach to comedy, it's defined his career and how he distinguishes himself.
I don't know if you need jokes, but I have jokes and I'm never going
to
use them.
You go up to Jay Leno and say, hey, man, you might need this.
That's exactly what I did. And he was like, okay.
He just decided that life can be hilarious if you just encourage people to talk.
Everybody out there's got a story. Everybody. And they never let me down.
This lawyer turned comedy writer turned comedian has so many stories, and some of them may be yours. Paul Mercurio, now on The Pulse.
My son's here. Alex, did I make mistakes?
At least one, right?
Guys, welcome to another episode of The Pulse. We talk to interesting people with fun stories, doing cool things, and Paul Mercurio kind of has all of those things wrapped into one. So, comedian, I've been joking with you on other shows.
Yeah.
Emmys, Peabody's.
Yeah. Boy Scout.
Yeah, all that.
Brown belt in karate.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Are you really?
Yeah, but I couldn't do anything though. I'd throw my back out.
Right. But you had that training.
Oh, see,
you know, yeah. Actor, like a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, yeah. Hosting my podcast because it's the law. Everybody has to have one. But yeah, I like one-on-one long-form interviews. So yeah, I'm doing a bunch of different stuff.
So, and the one-on-one long-form interviews, it's like a kind of a cool segue because part of the reason you're out and about on tour is because you're out and about on tour.
Right.
Going
exactly.
And your comedy routine, The Permission to Speak.
Right.
It's unique. Like it's like that. It's more conversation than stand-up.
Yeah. There is stand-up and there is my story. There are my stories in it, but it was born out of crowd work and talking to people, and then just this chit-chat started to turn into these crazy stories, and people were like, some producers saw me doing it and like, were those people planned? So I'm like, no, how did it all work out? I'm like, I don't know. I just talk to people. I listen and they do whatever. And then I got a question. And it's like, wow, okay. And so that's kind of how it was born. And we turned it into a show for Broadway and off Broadway. And it's not a stand-up show. There's like, we have a set. It's designed. It is and it isn't stand-up. We have a set designed by the set designer for the late show. We have animation by J.J. Settlemyer, who did Beavis and Butthead and all the SNL TV Funhouse videos.
Okay.
So it's a kind of a multimedia show, but at the core of it, it's my jokes and stories and people's stories, because everybody out there's got a story. Everybody. And they never let me down. And like, and so you just kind of go with it. Like, we had this couple. They're in their 70s. Sweet couple. And not from New York, from another part of the country. And I said, how did you meet? The woman giggles, she gets red, and she goes, spankme.com. I'm like, what? She goes, spank. He goes, yeah.
What?
And then he goes, yeah. She goes, I'm a sub and he's a dom. And we, yes, yes. Your producer
this
is like,
happened
I
at
swear
the show.
To God. And they look like your grandmother and grandfather or your aunt and your uncle. He's got like L.L. Bean shoes on. Like, he does, they don't look like sex or whatever. So like, there are these stories from people. Or, you know, we had this, I had this guy, looked like he was in a bad mood. I said, what's going on? He goes, I just broke up with my girlfriend. What happened? He goes, well, she wouldn't listen to me. I go, what happened? I told her not to shoplift at CVS. And I'm like, wait, did you say at CVS? He goes, yeah, yeah. He goes, I taught her how to shoplift. Anyway, I go, no, wait, not anyway. Come back.
Keep moving that story.
He goes, yeah, yeah. He goes, that's how I make money. I've been stealing stuff since I was 12. I'd steal bikes in the neighborhood and then sell them back to the kids or I'd beat them up. Now the audience is like, what is going on here? And he thinks it's normal. So apparently his girlfriend just kept bugging him about
like, learning how to shoplift.
Yes, to the point, because she wanted nice stuff. Like, he would only shoplift at nice places like Saks and Neiman Marcus, and he'd get nice stuff. And he'd sell some of it and he'd keep some of it. And he looked like $1 million, but he kind of talked like this. He was kind of like a mook, but he was like, whatever. But he had but he looked like a Wall Street guy because he was stealing the stuff. So I go, what happened? He goes, well, she wore me down. I taught her how to shoplift. What does she do? First place she goes to, CVS. I get a phone call in the middle of the night. She's in the back of a squad car. She got arrested for lipstick and a hand mirror. And it's like, and he was so, I want you to understand, everybody watching, he was upset with her not because of a moral issue of shoplifting.
No, where?
Where? If you're going to do it right.
Yeah, and make it worth it.
And make it worth it.
Like, go steal real. So, don't embarrass me with the skills I taught you by going out there and stealing crappy stuff.
You're not going
stuff.
Out with that thing you stole from TJ Maxx, are you? You got to go out with something from... So,
wow.
So what's really been cool about this is almost this like cultural sort of analysis of the world. Like, you, like, look, we're all in our silos, right? We got our wives, we got our kids, we got a this, the that, and this job, and we're all like this. But if you look up every once in a while and go, oh, that's how other people live their lives. You don't have to judge it. You don't have to agree with it, because we don't judge anybody in my show. You just, like, put it out there. Because
yeah.
The point of the show is we're nameless and faceless and disconnected and divisive. But if we get together and share stories, realize we're all kind of screwed up. We're trying to do the best we can. We have more in common than we think. The problem is politically where we are now, nobody has a sense of humor about anything. So if you're far left and I'm far right, we're never going to be able to even debate.
Can't even have a conversation.
But if I, through my show, get you to see, wait, you're married, I'm married. You got a two-year-old, I got a two-year-old. Your dog poops everywhere, my dog poops. Oh, this guy's not the devil. He's like me. So maybe I'll listen to what he has to say about politics. Now, I don't know if that's happening. This is not a political show, and I don't tell people what to think.
Right.
It's just come inside. We're going to have some drinks. We're going to hang out in this giant basement called the theater and have some drinks and share some stories. And then I'm going to tell my crazy stories because my life is all over the place.
Yeah, just and open conversation that we're not really having.
Yeah.
And life is funny. Even when you don't necessarily plan on it.
Yeah, and you know, and you got to laugh at yourself. Like, I'm a terrible father. I shouldn't be a father. I am. I'm terrible. I don't know. You don't know what you're doing. You know? And then there are some days you wish your kid would walk into the woods and never come back. They're very annoying, right? Any parent or not, you know what I'm talking about. Like, my kid was 7. He had a baseball tournament. This 3-day father's weekend. My wife's like, you should go, like, a father-son bonding weekend. And I went. And at the end of the weekend, it hit me. I don't really care for the kid. Hear me out. Because every minute of the day, it's there. No.
There's so many parents who are watching right now going, he speaks truth.
Thank you.
Like that.
Thank
that
you.
Guy.
Because you don't realize until you're in it that you have your life for like 22 years, it's gone. Like, it's all them all the time. So I take my kid on the trip. We're in a hotel room. He wants to eat. He's in a hotel. They overcharge for everything. It's $18 for a grilled cheese sandwich with no french fries and a shriveled up pickle. Then they burn one corner of it and the little baby can't eat it. I got to get another grilled cheese sandwich. I'm $36 in the bread and cheese. I got nothing to show for it. Then I take him to a bar. He starts complaining. Daddy, this Jack Daniels is burning my throat.
No, like, man up, kid.
Walk it off.
Oh, right? This is so, it's interesting though, because that, it feels like for a comedian and a talented comedian, it almost feels counterintuitive because you have to be secure enough with what you're doing to let other people shine in
yeah,
some
that's
of
a really
these
good point. So my director, Frank Oz, we talk about that a lot. And he has a rule for me, which is like 70-30. Like 70% story, 30% funny. Don't force the funny. He says, you know, you're naturally funny. It'll emerge from the story like the shoplifter.
Yeah.
And then you'll riff on it. But he's absolutely right. So if you and I are talking in the show and you're telling me, I don't know, this story about your car and how it got stolen or whatever, and then I got a joke about a car and then I get in the way and I do my joke about the car and then you're like whatever. Because I also have to remember, these people aren't performers.
Right.
But here's the amazing thing. Everybody, if they're comfortable, everybody's funny. Everybody watching is funny with their close friends and family because they're comfortable. And once they get up there and they know this is in a crowd work show where I'm making fun of them, it's a crowd work show on steroids in terms of how deep we get, but I'm not making fun of you. I'm just truly curious about your life. Like that shoplifter guy,
yeah.
I talked to him for 25 minutes. My show's an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, you're also an attorney, so you were like, we might want to spend
yeah,
this
exactly.
just a little bit.
He's in jail right now.
You know,
and that's me.
But it was very funny.
It was very, and it was worth, you know, I'm keeping the streets safe. So, like, people will be really like they can tell stories perfectly, know where the punchline is and deliver it. So yeah, you got to listen though. Like, you can't be ahead of yourself. You got to really listen because you'll get a piece of gold and then you run with it.
Was that the plan? Like, was it always that? Because you had, I mean, you maybe you did. You write for some great shows. You're brilliant. I'm gonna give you all that credit.
Okay. Are you talking to somebody behind me?
Yeah,
that is not me.
It's like you. Yeah. see them. Was it the plan, or did you kind of start doing this
something? Yeah, we talked about this off air. Like, I've worked on The Daily Show, The Late Show, and now in The Colbert Report. The best bits that we've come up with, like on The Daily Show, is stuff where you were working on something else, and then an idea spilled out of that, and that became better than the thing you were working on.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with this. This was simply me fighting. Like, I don't know, I felt like there was a rule. You got to go on stage and start doing jokes. And it just felt weird to me. Like, if you go into a dinner party, you don't just start, you're not on, you start talking. Right. Well, to me, a comedy club or a theater is like a giant dinner party. Like, it's all these people. I'm not going to talk to them for a minute. So then I say something to somebody, and then they'd give me a great story, and I keep going. And so that's kind of how it happens.
It's such a good idea, you know, and to see it in action and see what happens. And you're right. People are up there, and they don't even know that they're funny sometimes.
Right.
And the whole crowd starts laughing, and your response is, but I'd imagine, you know, interviewing people, that could be really hard. Because you have to, like a friend of mine once described very similar thing to what you're doing. It's like being a hockey goalie. Like, you never know what direction something is coming at you, but you've got to be prepared for everything.
But you can kind of run it, and it's fine. And, you know, you just go, you know, and so what ends up happening is, like, you get into it, and then they forget that there's an audience there very quickly. Or I might just talk to them from the seat. And by the way, if you come and you don't want to talk, you don't have to talk either. It's not like everybody, you know.
Right.
I'm doing a lot of my comedy in it, and we've got this other component to it. But like,
it's like, you know, I paid for you to tell jokes, funny
man.
Yeah,
exactly.
I come here, we're going to split the check.
People come up and say they want 10% of my money. But like, I do a thing we call the flip, because my director said, you've got to have something invested here. So I let somebody come up, I give them the microphone, and they can ask me any question they want. And then I get asked, you know, about like my background, like former lawyer turned comedian, and how that happened. And
what's the craziest thing anybody asked you? Anything you didn't want to answer?
Yeah. What's your favorite sex position?
Okay.
So I showed them. And come on, everybody. I can do it. I also did porn.
There you go.
No, but like, and so, and people, you know, so I got to remember that my life's something they want to hear about too, right?
Yeah.
Like, so like I, you know, I was a lawyer on Wall Street and was doing mergers and acquisitions. And
even that's kind of an odd story though, because you were successful on Wall Street. At some point, you're just like, this comedy thing, I'm gonna get, so you just started writing jokes. No, like, tell the story.
It's like we were just talking about like how this stuff just happens organically. I did not like plan, okay, I'm going to go to college. I'm going to go to Georgetown Law School in D.C. Then I'm going to go to New York and do corporate M&A. Then I'm going to leave and go into comedy and live like a pauper. Like, that's not a plan. And if you make that plan, you should be in a rubber room somewhere, right? So, or lobotomized. I just always loved comedy. But I didn't plan to do it. I'm sorry, I was watching comedy when I was a kid, and I would go in school, and I was funny in school, and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, like other kids, you know. And then I started writing jokes and short film ideas in law school. And then I bought a camera. I started making films when I was a lawyer. Then I started writing jokes. And I don't know why. But I only know that it was coming out of me and it was in there. And as people told me later, it was always there. And it was going to come out one way or the other.
So is the Jay Leno story true?
Oh, absolutely. So what happened was, I'm working like 100-hour weeks doing big merger and acquisition deals. Like, no spare time. But I'm writing jokes. And I would write them in a passworded file at work, so nobody would know. And because it's like there's an information processing system at these big law firms where they have people just work on the stuff. Years later, I'll get to the Leno story in a minute. Years later, like just last year, we had an alumni event for my law firm. And this old guy comes up to me. He goes, "You remember me?" I go, "What?" He goes, "I'm Alan Dindis." I go, "He goes, oh, Alan." He ran the information processing system at the firm. He goes, "A lot of nights you made me laugh. I'd break into your documents and read your jokes."
What?
Yeah. So I'm working one night. I got all these jokes. I find out that there's this big party, big fancy party that some client's doing down in the financial district of New York. Jay Leno's a private entertainment. I'm like, you know what? I need a break. I'm going to go for like an hour or two. I'm going to come back and work all night again. And I remember to this day, I stood up, I put my overcoat on, and I'm standing over my keyboard, and I'm like, screw it. And I hit the print button. And I always think, like, if I didn't do that, would I be here, right? And I don't know why I did it. So I printed out these jokes like that thick, and I take them down with me in the thing, and I watch Jay, and then Jay comes off, and I go up to him, and I go, I don't know if you need jokes, but I have jokes, and I'm never going
to
use them.
You go up to Jay Leno and say, hey, man, you might need this.
That's exactly what I did. And he was like, okay. And his head's moving around. It's giant, and it's like a balloon in a Macy's tank. It's unruly. It's like you want to watch out it doesn't hit guy wires. And he's like, and it's like it literally, like it's like helium coming out of And I walk away, and he goes, wait, come back. I go, what? He goes, you might want to put your name and your phone number on here so I know how to reach you. Like, here I am, Mr. Lawyer, right?
Right.
So now I'm like, forget about it. A few days later, phone rings. It's Jay Leno. It's Paul there. I'm like, to myself, there's no way. Thank you, that right. face. Like, thank it. You. There's no way Jay Leno's calling me. So I think it's my friend David who likes to pull pranks. And he knew I met Jay Leno. And I'm like, really funny. And I was like really in a bad mood. I had pulled an all-nighter. I was on a deadline. He goes, no, really, it's Jay Leno. I go, yeah, right. He goes, David, I know it's you. He goes, no, it's Jay Leno. I go, David, I do not have time. He goes, it's Jay Leno. And I actually said to Jay Leno, you do a lousy Jay Leno. I swear to God. And he goes, I think I do a pretty good me. I'm like, oh, Jesus, it's Jay Leno. And he goes, look, I read your stuff, and I need stuff for the Tonight Show monologue and my act. I'll pay you $50 a joke, whatever I use.
What?
And then
that doesn't happen.
I know. And then he goes to me, what do you do for a living? I go, I'm a lawyer. He goes, ah, I knew it. I go, why? He goes, you write like a lawyer. You're too wordy. He goes, you're writing a joke, not the Magna Carta. Get to the punchline already.
See, and that's when you're like, yo, you called me.
Yeah, exactly.
What's up with the attitude, man? You wanted my
Thank
jokes.
You. And then like a week later, my phone rings again. It's Jay. It's Paul there. I'm like, Jay, what do you want? What? Don't you have Hollywood?
Busy. I told you I was an attorney.
I'm hanging out with Alan Dindis. I don't need this. He goes, I'm going to do your joke on The Tonight Show tonight.
And that?
I got a bottle of champagne. Got together with my girlfriend and my wife, another couple. Does a joke. Everybody laughs at it. And it blows my head off my shoulders. And then I start to... do the joke, write jokes, and then Jay says, go try the jokes out. So I start to live.
Do them yourself.
So I start to live a secret double life where I'm an attorney and investment banker by day because I couldn't tell the firm. This is one of the biggest firms in the world.
Right.
They'd be like, that's not appropriate. Our attorneys don't do that. And I couldn't tell because I was working dive bars. You start out, you work like hellholes and like people are like, they'll roll you for your, right? So like I would have a car service. I would charge it to the client. I'd have them drive me down to a dive bar, park two blocks away. I'd take my suit and jacket off and stuff. And I'd walk into a bar and I'd wait. And one of the places I worked was called Downtown Beirut 2. Two!
What?
They were either franchising
these. Expansion. You guys, yeah, exactly. You got a great idea.
Yeah, exactly.
You need more of those.
Right. Or somebody blew up one. I don't know. And I'm waiting to go on. And the drug deals out of there. Hookers, homeless people. It was like, and then comedians. It was like a Tuesday night open mic night. And I'm waiting to go on stage. And the guy on stage playing Blowing in the Wind badly. Like, yeah, it's everything terrible. And I'm next to go up. All of a sudden, there's a scuffle at the pool table. Guy cuts another guy with a knife across like the arm.
Like, what?
And yeah, and I, apparently it was a drug deal gone bad and they knew each other but the guy he got cut was like really drunk. He's he cut me, man. He cut me. I was in that. And the girlfriend starts crying, oh my God, look at my boyfriend. He cut me. He cut me. The answer, my friend. The guy just keeps playing. He's not getting off. I swear to God, this is all true. He's not getting off. So I start to get up from the bar. I'm like, okay, well, this show's
right,
over.
I'm gonna
go back to it, right? And as I turn, I'll never forget this, my back is to the stage and I hear, all right, you guys ready for some comedy? I'm like,
so
what?
You came on following the bad music, the person getting stabbed,
blood.
The girlfriend going nuts, blood everywhere,
now,
drug deal.
Thank you. And I'm not doing this long enough to know I don't have to go on. Like, I think I have to go on, so I go on. But I have the presence of mind to go, now it's mayhem. Like, the cops are there, this guy's bleeding. Like, I got to acknowledge the craziness. So I go, nice to be here at Downtown Beirut 2. I always wanted to follow a slashing,
right.
Which, you know, I think is a pretty good line. Well, the guy heard me say that, who got slapped, and he had all these bloody cocktail napkins, and he's like, hey, you talking to me? I don't need to take any crap from you. And he takes all the napkins and he throws them at me. And they stick to my, right here, my ribcage, my white Brooks Brothers shirt, like right there. So I get off stage, end of story. I go back to the firm. I'm gone for like 2 hours. They couldn't find me. Like the senior partner's like really mad. I walk into a conference room. I'm trying to hide the blood stain with like a file folder, like a 12-year-old. You're like, I don't care how you turn into a 12-year-old, right? And the guys
when you get knife blood on
yeah,
you,
exactly. I
wouldn't know. Like, go ahead. Like, exactly. I'll take your word for it. Like, okay.
And the guy, you know when your dad or your mom yells at you, they're so mad they can't see straight. They're just like veins. And he's like, where have you been? What have you been doing? Why do you have a blood stain on your shirt? And I'm like, oh man, my secret's out. I don't know what to say. And another lawyer goes, what kind of shirt is that? I go, it's a Brooks Brothers shirt. He goes, oh, I know how to get blood out of a Brooks Brothers shirt.
Dude, and then you're like, see, everybody's got a story.
Thank you very much.
I need to go ahead
there
and do this.
I gotta go do
That's
this.
Insane.
Yeah.
But so but that wasn't the end. Like, you kept doing law for a while.
Yeah.
To the point where, now we're just kind of talking and you're sharing stories. Right?
Yeah.
It's a fact check of all the stuff that I read. So you're sneaking around doing this. And when I say sneaking, your wife didn't even know.
No, because my wife and I have been together since high school, and she works in museums. And now at this point, we own our first apartment in New York City, and we're kind of set.
Doing all
right.
I mean,
I'm not a partner. I don't have whatever, but I'm on a track, right? And I felt really self-conscious about this because I thought it was juvenile and childish. And when you work on Wall Street, and particularly mergers and acquisitions, which is like,
right.
Hey, I'm
fancy.
I'm a dude. It's a macho thing. That part of Wall Street is a very much a macho thing. It may have changed, but then it was. Like, my boss was one of the guys in Vietnam that with a pistol would go into the tunnels that the Viet Cong would dig and snake them out. He was like a psycho.
That guy. Okay.
Yeah. So I didn't tell her. And then I finally came home one night and I said, I got to tell you something. She goes, I go, what you got? I think I want to leave Wall Street to be a comedian. And she goes, that better be your first joke. And I said, no. And she goes, what have you been doing? I go, well, I've been doing this stand-up. And she goes, oh, thank God. And I go, why? She goes, well, I thought you were cheating on me. Because I was coming home reeking of beer and cigarettes, blood stains.
Blood stains, right.
And I had phone numbers of women in my jacket. But it was other comedians that had rooms, but she thought I was like, whatever. And I'm like, no, I'm not cheating. I go, there's one hooker at downtown Beirut too. But other than that, none of them.
I haven't seen her in weeks.
I haven't seen her in weeks. I think she was knifed. No. And so she's like the most amazing person because material things don't matter to her. And she was like, okay, well, you know, that's what you want to do. But at that point, I still hadn't decided to leave. I just was like, doing it, and I couldn't stop. But, like, it was crazy. Like, one time because I was having a nervous breakdown because I was trying to hide it from everybody. So I'm doing, like, an open mic night at, like, a pretty nice restaurant. They had a back room. It's, like, a Wednesday night. And who walks in but the wives of two of the senior partners of my law firm who I know. So now I duck behind the bar, and I say to the MC, bring me up as Paul Windmill. He goes, what? He goes, Paul, that Windmill Street's what I grew up on. It sounds like a porn name, right?
Right.
That's what they say, like, take your voice,
listen,
right?
Your nothing you say is surprising me anymore. So, whatever. So let's just go with it.
He goes, bring me up as Paul Windmill. So he brings me up as Paul Windmill. And I do the entire, so if you're the audience, like here, I do the entire set, like, with my side to the audience like this, so she wouldn't know that I was, and I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to have a nervous breakdown at, like, whatever I was, late 20s. And so I had to kind of make a decision.
That's insane. And I mean, in hindsight, a couple of things. One, just met you, never met your wife. You got to keep her.
No, she's amazing.
Because for her to go through all of that.
She's amazing.
Like,
but come on, she's not going to drop me.
I got you. Yeah, I mean, that aside.
Come on.
Like, in the moment.
This doesn't just
happen. She was right. He's like, I woke up like this.
Look at my lips, ladies.
This is
home,
legit.
Huh?
But she was like, wait, we're going to have to move out the apartment?
Yes.
Like,
we can do all those things. We have to sell the apartment.
See? So that's
the one
legit
thing I feel bad about.
That you sold the apartment? I think it worked out in the end.
Yeah. I had to move to a rooming house and live with a two ex-cons and two recovering addicts for a couple of years. I swear to God.
This is so nuts.
It is.
But it also speaks to the fact that you proved, like, your life was the testing ground that if you sit there and have conversations with people and allow them the opportunity to speak, that there is entertainment and fun and stories.
In people's lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that we lose sight of that, you know? Like, and that's what, circling back to permission to speak, it's like, again, it's my stand-up and stories, but it's also the audience. And like, I've had people say, we're getting these amazing testimonials, like, keep doing the show. We need a show like this. It's great. It connects people, because that's the other theme of the show, is if we share stories, we have more in common. We realize we have more in common than we think, and we connect. And maybe we're a little bit better off if we connect for 5 minutes. So what's happening after the show? I'll never forget the first show we did. People weren't leaving. I'm like, is there something wrong? They're like, no, we don't know what's going on. It turned out people just started talking to each other. So you'd go on stage and say, I don't know, yeah, you're from Milwaukee, and there happens to be somebody from Milwaukee in the audience. Where are you from? And they start talking to each other. I did the show in Sellersville, not far from here, about a year ago, and a guy on stage plays golf. I see him at we go to a bar after the show, and he's hanging out with a guy who he just met. Turns out that guy plays golf at the same country club, and they were going to go play golf the next day, the next week. So like,
so it's like comedic icebreaker.
This is like,
just bringing everybody,
I'm bringing everybody together.
See, though, you're a champion of the people.
I'm a humanity. And the weird thing is, people annoy me generally, but this doesn't. Like in private life, I've actually come up with an idea. I'm got a line of welding helmets that I'm coming out with, designer welding helmets.
Okay.
So if I'm in a conversation with you and it's boring, I just like, sorry, I got to.
I got some welding to do.
Yeah, you just walk away.
Okay, yeah, I'm not sure you thought this one through, but it's an interesting concept.
I was going to ask you to invest.
Yeah.
Come on, you got money. Look, you have like a pocket square. You got cash.
Yeah, I spent my money on the pocket square. Like, I work here. What
Come
are you
on,
talking
you
about?
You got four pieces of garment on. You got money.
No, so that speaks to the fact that I don't have any money. And you know this because you were on other shows at the station. So all of this is we had Paul on a couple shows. And I can't wear the same outfit
right.
on every show.
Right.
But I don't have a wardrobe
right,
budget.
But the weird thing is you're still not wearing
put
pants.
The jacket on. I can't afford pants.
Oh, okay.
I spent the money on the pocket square
Let me
and
give
all
you these.
The things. See? There's a lot going
told
on.
You, I'm a giver.
So I feel like we could talk forever, but unfortunately, shows end. We haven't talked much about the podcast at all. Mm. So you're on tour, doing the comedy thing, stepping out. But you've launched this podcast, and I absolutely understand why, because the conversations are amazing. But you've gotten some pretty cool folks to come in and sit down and talk to you.
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy. And I'm not being rude. I'm just going to get something for this story on my phone. So
okay.
I like... you know, when you work on shows like I've worked on, The Daily Show, The Late Show, The Late Show, they're marketing shows, right?
Yeah.
You have these amazing, genius, creative people or authors. They come on and they have 6 or 7 minutes to sell what they're selling. But you never get into process. And I'm a process geek. And I think that's why Permission to Speak works. Like, I have this, like, I'll just keep asking questions. You're a great interviewer. You do the same thing. Like, there's a lot there. So I was like, I'm just going to do a podcast where I'm just talking to people that I want to talk to, long form, from all walks of life. So we have everybody from Bryan Cranston to John Meacham, the historian, Thomas Friedman, New York Times, Jay Leno, Bill Burr, and Paul McCartney. And I got Paul McCartney on my podcast.
Okay.
And I'm fascinated by musicians. I can't do music, how they put all of those sounds together. Then they write words. Like, I could barely write a sentence, but they're like... So he's at the Late Show. He's doing the show, and he just finished his rehearsal. And he's so you got to go down the stairs to get in the studio. So I'm running late because I got to do something in the studio. And I round the corner, and standing in the hallway all alone is Paul McCartney, just like this, leaning up against the wall, chewing gum, looking up at the ceiling like he's waiting for a bus, all alone. Not a man. Now, you've worked in this business. You know,
yes.
People have handlers and managers.
Yes.
He is completely, he doesn't have a parrot on his shoulder. Nothing, right? So I see him and my whole world slows down. I'm like, oh my God, it's Paul McCartney. and then I'm like, should I say hi? Should I not say hi? And I'm like, you know what? He's alone.
Right.
No security. He's like a gazelle on the Serengeti Plains. I'm a lion. I'm going to pounce. So I go up to him and I go, it's an honor to meet you. Huge fan, looking forward to seeing. And I walk away and he goes, wait, come back. I'm like, what? What do you want?
No.
First Leno, now you. What do you guys want from me?
Like,
I'm only one person. He goes, what's your name? I go, Paul. He goes, oh, Paul, that's a good name. I'm like, I'll do the jokes, buddy. Just play a little guitar.
No.
So he goes, what do you do? I go, well, I'm a stand-up. I work on this show. I was working on The Daily Show at the time, too. Blah, blah, blah. Same time, blah, blah, blah. And we start talking. Oh, yeah, you travel, tour. Yeah, I tour, touring stuff, right? Yeah, you got a kid? Yeah, I got a kid. How old? Blah, blah. 5-10 minutes go by. I'm talking to Paul McCartney like I'm talking to you. Mm-hmm. Now, on the outside, I'm like, smooth talking to Paul McCartney. On the inside, I'm like, I'm talking to Paul McCartney! Like, out of my mind. Like, you know, the girls in Shea Stadium in, like, 1963 going nuts? Like, that was me. And as I'm talking to him, it's like, I don't know if it's like you meet somebody in a bar and you want to, like, try to ask him out, like, you bifurcate your mind. So one part is on the conversation. The other part is like, keep it going. Keep it going. Say something else. What else can you...
What can I
so
say? Like,
and as I'm talking to him...
How do I get the
him,
digits?
And as I'm talking to him, I'm getting closer and closer to his face. I am like checking him out. I swear to God. Because he's Paul McCartney. He's iconic. It's like meeting... Right? So and as he's against the wall, so he can't get away from me. So I have him pinned against the wall. And he's literally... Like my face is like this close. And I'm like... Oh, oh, oh. And I was so close... I could have been like the chimps on the Discovery Channel where they clean fleas off their mates. I could have cleaned ticks off his eyebrows. Like, I was like that close. I could have been like... So then I'm like, okay, I'm going to leave the guy alone. I go into the bathroom. I call my wife. I'm hyperventilating. I'm like, you're not going to believe it. I just met Paul. And then I blurt these words out. Paul McCartney should do my podcast. Like, that's what I say in my crazy brain.
That's not crazy at all.
So I go and I knock on the dressing room door and I go, I know this is going to... sound crazy, but I would love to talk to you about how you make music. I don't want to talk to you about any of the salacious stuff, just how you make music and your creative process. Would you do my podcast? And he goes, yeah, sure. Just like that.
It's the craziest thing. And we actually have to start to wrap up, but it's the craziest thing.
Yeah.
It's my favorite part of this show.
Right.
Twofold. One, you find out if you get some time with people that they really are just people.
Yeah.
Most of them. Some of them are jerks.
Yeah.
But they really are just people and mostly
and they
cool.
want to be treated like people.
Right. And if you respect them that way and have a conversation,
really
they're
good
cool.
point.
You also find out that all of the, not all of it, much of the craziness that you read about in the tabloids and Hollywood and the crazy demands and the, it's not them.
No.
It's handlers and people around them.
You totally
They're just really nice, pleasant people.
I found out the reason this happened most likely is that I didn't ask him for an autograph or a picture. I just talked to the guy. He's a regular guy who has a job. And I think that that was refreshing for him because I didn't want anything from him
right.
until I did. But I know
but even that wasn't a gotcha moment. It's like I'm actually curious about your story and your experience. I'm not trying to trap you in something.
No, exactly. And I really I think he could tell I was sincerely interested in his creative process. And so real quick end of story, he says, yeah, sure, how do we do it? I freeze. I'm like, I go, I'll come to London. He goes, we're in a room in New York together. Why would you come to London?
Right.
And then he goes, is it easy to do? I go, yeah, I know you're busy. You could do it on your phone naked from your toilet. I'm like, what am I saying? So I go, look, I'll leave you alone. I'll get your assistant. We'll set up. He goes, no, you and I'll do it. I go, what do you mean? He goes, we're going to exchange numbers because they're going to make it too complicated. And
so
when
you
I call,
Paul
you got to be ready
number.
To do it. So he does a show. I do the show. I'm running late. End of story here. My phone rings. I don't recognize the number. I let it ring the voicemail. And this is the
you
message.
Still have this voicemail.
This is the message on my phone.
Hey, bro. It's Paul McCartney here. I'm going to ring you back in 5 minutes to do the podcast thing. I've got some time now. Otherwise, I'm going to run out of time. So if you're there in 5 minutes' time, you got me. Okay, bye.
That's
I retrieved
amazing.
This message on 53rd Street and 11th Avenue, and this is what you would see if you saw me. Idiot! Morons! Green call! And I threw my phone down the street. I'm like, how am I ever going to get this guy back? And sure enough, I called. I had to stall him for an hour till I got a recording line, and he did it. And he couldn't have been a nicer guy.
That's amazing. That's that is a keeper.
No,
you save that forever.
I have it in eight. I have it on my butt. I have it in eight places. I have it in 20 places.
Paul Mercurio is on tour, has the podcast, doing performances, all kinds of things. We appreciate you spending time with us.
Thank you.
We end every show with the concept of using your voice for good. I ask everybody to end the same question. What does the phrase "use your voice for good" mean to you?
Right now, try to connect people. And it's bad, and it's not a political thing. It's like we just got to lower the temperature and whatever. And so, not to be self-serving, but that's kind of the point of the show that I'm doing. It's guys, trust me, watching out there, it's comedy. I want you to think we're going to come in there and lecture you. We're having a lot of laughs, but a subtle thing is happening underneath, and intentionally subtle, which is we're going to just connect because I just think we're so disconnected, and it's really unhealthy. So that would I guess, not to sound too cheesy, I think that would be my thing.
I think it would be impossible to watch this interview and not want to see your show.
Oh, I appreciate it, man. Well, you're really great at what you do.
I appreciate that.
You really, really are. You listen. I can't tell you how many interviews I do with people. You could tell the person's not listening and they're looking at their notes and you're engaging and you're nice. I wish you would wear pants, but I can, you know.
Baby steps.
Maybe your producer could buy you pants.
It's baby
there's
steps.
There's like Filene's Basement. I don't know if they're still around. You could go to a Goodwill store.
This interview does what I expect it to do. Next time, I'll be able to afford pants.
By the way, you have tremendous thighs. Right. I'm not getting creepy, but I'm just saying. It's not my fault you put your thighs out there like that.
Thanks for watching. Leave it there. Thank you. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having
time
me.
With
a lot
us.
Of fun.
Guys, thanks so much for listening to the Pulse with Bill Anderson podcast. Today with comedian, writer, he's done some acting, has a podcast, jack of all trades and mastering many of them, Paul Mercurio. Just fun and informative to sit there and have the opportunity to share stories with him, to hear his experiences, and to understand kind of the origin of such an amazing career and successful show tour that he's on right now. Hope you enjoyed it. Do me a favor, hit the like, follow, subscribe, whatever it says on your screen so you get a notification every time a new episode of The Pulse comes out every week. I encourage you to download the Fox Local app so that you have all of our shows, all episodes right there at your fingertips. And hit me up on social media at Bill A. Fox 29 on all platforms. I'm always interested in hearing from you. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. And I leave you today, as I always do, reminding you whenever you can, use your voice for good and have a good one.